Stone. Wanna see my picture on the cover? Stone. Wanna buy 5 copies for my mother? Yeah. Wanna see my smiling face on the cover of the Rolling Stone? This is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Reading from the Rolling Stone magazine, the March 2025 edition. Continuing with the Rolling Stone special report, Apocalypse Los Angeles. With the article, Why LA Burned. The fires show we're unprepared for life on a hotter planet, by Jeff Goodell. We're in serious trouble. That's the message I saw written in the ashes of Los Angeles. And by we, I mean every human on this planet, rich or poor, young or old, black or white or brown. In L.A., an $83 million house with 18 bedrooms and 6 bathrooms burned just as fast as fixer-uppers next to the freeway. We're in trouble not because we're helpless or because we have broken the planet beyond repair. We're in trouble because we live in a world that was built for a climate that no longer exists, and the rebuilding of our world to adapt to this new, hotter, more dangerous climate is a task that we have hardly begun to undertake. We are like dinosaurs wandering around after the meteor hit, thinking that the ash that is blocking out the sun is going to dissipate at any moment and everything will go back to normal. We are much smarter than the dinosaurs, but we are also deeply stupid in our own way. Millions of Americans think that because they have their own YouTube channel and AI on their phones and overnight Amazon deliveries, that they have Mother Nature whipped, that she is just some old hag that we've banished to the basement of modern life. The Los Angeles fires were burning evidence of how dangerous this delusion is. The fires were a bonfire of bad ideas that have piled up over decades, from suburban sprawl into wildfire zones to the flammable plastics that now fill many people's homes. But beyond all that is a larger fact that the Los Angeles fires have demonstrated to anyone who cares to look how unprepared we are for what is coming for us on a superheated planet. You could argue that lots of other climate-related disasters demonstrated that, too, from broken levees during Hurricane Katrina in 2005, to the fire tornadoes during the Camp Fire in Northern California in 2018, to the epic heat wave in the Pacific Northwest in 2021. But the Los Angeles fires peeled back the fire blanket of unpreparedness to reveal a new level of vulnerability to the human-induced mood swings of Mother Nature. If there has been a single fatal flaw in the design of Southern California as a civilization, California historian and urban theorist Mike Davis wrote in his classic 1998 book, Ecology of Fear, it has been the decision to base the safety of present and future generations almost entirely upon short-sighted extrapolations from the disaster record of the past half century. First, let's get one thing out of the way. No, climate change did not cause the LA fires. The sparks that ignited the fires were almost certainly human sparked, likely by power lines or fireworks. Whatever the ignition source was, fires have been a part of the chaparral ecosystem in the mountains around LA since the beginning of time. Native plants that thrive in the San Gabriel Mountains, behind Altadena, the community in the northeastern part of Los Angeles County where the Eaton Fire destroyed more than 9,400 buildings and at least 17 people died, as well as above Malibu and the Pacific Palisades, where another 6,800 buildings burned and at least 12 people died, are exquisitely adapted to fire. The California lilac, a common plant in these mountains, drop seeds that only germinate in the aftermath of fire. Chamise and manzanita are glossy with oils and resins that seal in moisture during hot, dry periods and easily explode into flame during a wildfire. The best way to think about the role of climate change in the LA fires is as an accelerant.
Last year was the hottest on Earth ever recorded by humans. 10 of the hottest years have all been in the past decade. And the source of all that heat is no mystery. It's mostly a consequence of our addiction to coal, oil, and gas. With more heat comes more fire. A study released a few weeks after the fires found that the hot, dry, windy conditions that drove the LA fires were about 35% more likely due to warming caused primarily by the burning of fossil fuels. A thirstier atmosphere is an inevitable consequence of a warmer area, says Daniel Swain, a climate scientist at UCLA. Swain talks about a hotter atmosphere as a bigger sponge, one that soaks up 7% more water for every 1 Celsius degree of warming. That means it sucks the moisture out of the ground and out of the plants. As anyone who's ever tried to build a campfire knows, drier wood burns easier than wet or damp wood. And when that wood does catch fire, it burns faster and more intensely. A 2023 study found that climate change is responsible for nearly all of the observed increase in wildfire burned area in California over the past half century. A hotter climate is also a more extreme climate. Swain was the lead author on a recent study that described climate's role in amplifying weather extremes. He and his co-authors coined the term hydroclimate whiplash, in which decades of drought are followed by periods of heavy rainfall and then a return to very dry conditions, causing vegetation to grow rapidly before becoming a landscape of tinder ready to combust. This is exactly what happened before the fires in LA. The 2 years prior to 2024 were extremely wet, causing plants to grow like crazy and luckily filling up California reservoirs. Then, starting in May 2024, the rain stopped. Plants dried out. In LA, the summer was hot, but the fall was even hotter. Starting in early September, daytime temperatures were 10 to 20 degrees above normal for that time of year. A weather station in Long Beach, south of Los Angeles, hit 109 degrees on September 6th, a new daily record that was 25 degrees hotter than normal for that day of the year. By that time, the mountains around LA were like a giant pile of kindling. Any spark would ignite an inferno. In the fall, the Santa Ana winds arrived in Los Angeles. These winds are not a product of climate change. They are created by temperature changes related to the topography of the West. They begin out in Nevada's Great Basin, where high pressure zones cause the air to sink and flow towards lower temperature zones along the coast. On their way west, the winds blow across the Mojave Desert where they dry out. They blow through canyons in the San Gabriel Mountains and arrive in LA hot and dry and fast and full of mythological significance. It is hard for people who have not lived in Los Angeles to realize how radically the Santa Ana figures in the local imagination, Joan Didion wrote in the 1960s. She went on to say the city burning is Los Angeles' deepest image of itself. Usually rains come to LA in the late fall, dampening the risk of fire with the Santa Anas. Last fall, no rains came. But in January, the flames did. Gusts measured up to 90 miles per hour. Within a few years, what started as a small fire in the chaparral quickly spread to homes built at the edge of the wildlands, many of them big, expensive homes with nice views that have been built by people who wanted to be close to nature or wanted some buffer from the chaos of urban life. And that is when the fire changed from something that has been happening in the LA mountains since time began into a human-created nightmare. For the past 100 years or so, Los Angeles spread like a pancake batter over a hot, dry griddle. From the core of the city, the population moved horizontally out towards the beach and the valley. But the bigger the flatlands grew, the more the mountains beckoned. Movie stars sought refuge in the Hollywood Hills. Others were looking for cheap real estate or an escape from the smog. white people want a distance from the black and brown people on the flatlands. Zoning has encouraged this. No politician wants to get in the way of Californians' God-given right to own their little piece of paradise. It was there, in the places that the city planners called the wildland-urban interface, that the fire began to change from the kind of wildfire that has burned through these hills for millions of years into an urban fire, the likes of which no one has seen in America since the Great Chicago Fire of 1871 devastated that city, killing approximately 300 people and leaving a third of its residents homeless. 21st century cities aren't supposed to burn. After the urban fires of the 19th and early 20th century, building codes have been passed, fire standards implemented, and modern firefighting technology embraced. The problem in LA was none of that mattered much. In fact, in some cases, dependence on better firefighting technology made the situation worse, or at the very least, provided a false sense of security. Consider the airplanes and helicopters that the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection keeps ready to fight fires in mountainous, difficult-to-reach areas. CAL FIRE has the largest state-owned firefighting air fleet in the United States, which includes 23 air tankers, 11 helicopters, and 14 air tactical aircraft. The largest of these aircraft can dump more than 9,000 gallons of water or fire retardant, basically water and ammonium phosphate fertilizer mixed with pink dye, on fires, slowing their spread. But during crucial hours of both the Pacific Palisades and the Eaton fires, the high winds made it too dangerous to fly the aircraft, leaving them sitting on the tarmac while the fires spread into residential areas. Similarly, well-trained teams of firefighters and expensive fire trucks are of little use if they can't get to the fires. Many of the houses that were most at risk at the edge of the wildland burn zone, especially in the hills and canyons above the Pacific Palisades fire, had been built in places that were difficult or impossible to access with fire engines and crews. Often, there was only one access road jammed with vehicles of panicked people trying to escape. At one point, the LA Fire Department used bulldozers to push cars off the road so fire trucks could gain access. But the biggest fire accelerant was the homes themselves. Modern homes are full of plastic, making them burn hotter, faster, and more toxic than the house your grandmother grew up in. The couch you flop on to watch TV is probably made of polyester fabric wrapped around polyurethane foam and held together with engineered wood made with polymer-based glues. When it catches fire, it goes up like a can of gasoline or worse. When polyurethane foam burns, it releases deadly hydrogen cyanide gas. Then there is the foam insulation, vinyl flooring, laminate countertops, and the synthetic textiles in curtains and carpets and many of the clothes in your closet. In a fire, a modern house is its own flaming, toxic Superfund site, and it can burn for hours at temperatures as high as 2,000 degrees. In L.A., each burning home sent what Swain calls a blizzard of embers into the gusting wind, which eventually landed on dry roofs or were sucked into ventilation ducts of distant houses. Within a few hours, entire blocks were aflame. For Trump, the L.A. fires were like a Netflix series in which he played the king of chaos. He waged his usual war of disinformation and lies, doing everything he could to blame the fire on his nemesis, California Governor Gavin Newsom. Among other things, Trump accused Newsom, as Trump calls him, and California Democrats of diverting water from L.A. in order to save smelt, an endangered fish in the California Delta. Trump threatened to withhold federal relief funds if California did not send more of its water from the northern part of the state to L.A. It was all bullshit, of course. Los Angeles gets its water from underground aquifers, reservoirs in the southern Sierra Nevada mountains, and the Colorado River Aqueduct, In fact, the state reservoirs that store water used by Southern Californians were at or above full capacity for that time of the year. The problem was that the fires were so big and so fast-moving that the water supply system was quickly overwhelmed. Imagine trying to take a shower at the same time 10,000 neighbors also decide to shower. The pipes simply are not designed for that kind of flow. There was enough water in storage in Southern California to drown the fire-affected areas in 20 feet of water, but you couldn't get it to those places, one water expert told the New York Times. The problem with Donald Trump's lies is not only that they were insultingly stupid and divert time and attention when first responders are trying to save people's lives, but they also make it even more difficult for many people to see the true risks of life on a superheated planet, including the health risks that come from, say, breathing in air that contains the toxic, aerosolized remains of everything from bowling trophies to lithium batteries. Nowhere is this more clear than with homeowners insurance. Insurers are in the business of making money by accurately assessing risk, an increasingly tough thing to do in a rapidly changing climate. Insurers could face $45 billion in claims from the LA fires alone, increasing the likelihood that many companies will either dramatically jack up prices or leave the state altogether. Even before the fires, California's insurance market was already in crisis, as leading insurers had crunched the numbers and decided to abandon the state or not renew policies in fire-prone areas. More and more homeowners were forced to buy insurance from the state-backed FAIR plan, which is the insurer of last resort in those areas. Statewide, the number of FAIR plan policies in 2024 increased 41% from 2023, and 85% in the Pacific Palisades. But state-subsidized insurance, which shifts an enormous amount of financial risk to California residents, can only go on for so long before the good people of the Golden State revolt. As insurance costs soar, more homeowners may struggle to keep up with mortgage payments, risking widespread defaults. What will that do to the real estate market in Los Angeles? All the state's efforts so far, raising money to support the FAIR plan, sending money in for cleanup, making it easier for insurance companies to charge more, are aimed at mopping up the debris and keeping the mortgage machine going, says climate writer Susan Crawford. The shell game is ending. And this is just not a problem for LA, it's a problem for America. The scale of known risks from climate change amplified by future uncertainties is so enormous that a Treasury Council called it a threat to the financial stability of the United States. Then there is the invasion of the grifters, who circle over disaster zones like vultures over a dead body. Virtually every homeowner I talked to in Los Angeles said they had received calls from someone, sometimes they identified themselves, but often they didn't, who offered to buy their burned-out home for a fraction of its former value or to loan them money at an outrageous rate. It's predatory, says Samantha James, age 24, who is a sixth-generation Black Californian. Her family lost one home in a fire, and they had other homes damaged. Our family received multiple calls from predatory investors within one day of the fire, she says. My dad yelled at them and hung up. In L.A., where some wealthy residents hired private firefighters to protect their homes and private security guards watched over the burned-out streets, you can see a foreshadowing of what disaster relief will look like under the Trump administration. Goodbye FEMA, and any notion of a government response designed to aid those who need it most. You need help? Okay, but it's going to cost you. But disasters also have a way of bonding communities together. James, who co-founded a group called the Altadena Recovery Team to help residents in need, says she and her family were eager to rebuild their homes and resume their lives. So was virtually everyone else I talked to. She says, "Altadena, strong, we will rebuild," read a big banner downtown. Yes, they will, but at what cost and how? The future of LA is a future of heat, which means it's a future of fire. What will the extreme fire risk days in 20, 30, or 40 years look like? Swain asked during an interview on CNN. It's pretty clear that they will be even more extreme than what we're seeing today. And that's not only true in LA, but also in cities from Austin to Asheville, North Carolina, and San Diego to Vancouver, Canada. In this new, hotter world, fire is no longer just a wildland threat. It is a threat that is coming to a city near you. It's clear that Donald Trump sees climate chaos as a feature, not a bug. So don't expect a bold, forward-thinking response to help rebuild Los Angeles from any federal agency. Governor Newsom probably grasps the risk of the climate crisis as well as any politician in America, but he also understands the need to rebuild the burned-out city quickly. He has already signed a $2.5 billion Marshall Plan to clean up debris and cut red tape for reconstruction. In the short term, the politically expeditious thing to do is to allow everyone to build back more or less exactly what they had before. If that happens, it's like passing out tickets to a disaster theme park. Instead, city and state officials should push for high-density zoning, which would allow more green space and fire buffer zones. Together, building codes could reduce flammable materials in home construction. Water infrastructure needs to be upgraded and power lines buried. And most important, development should be restricted in high-risk areas that are guaranteed to burn again. None of this will be easy. There will be years of political infighting, courtroom battles, and financial chicanery. And even if all these reforms happen, it would still only be a small step in the much longer journey towards reinventing life on a hotter planet. As one gun-toting security guard standing watch over a burned-out bank in the Pacific Palisades put it to me, the author, "This is a fucking catastrophe. I sure hope we all learn something from it." The next article, the Rolling Stones series on freedom fighters, life during wartime. 3 years into Ukraine's defense of the Russian invasion, teenagers in Kyiv are forging a new normal. I met Karina on a sunny hillside in Eternal Glorin Park in central Kyiv last April. The spring tulips and cherry blossoms that lined the park were in full bloom. Ukraine's omnipresent flowers have a rebellious quality during wartime. We sat to talk as the shouting and hawking of a nearby protest to free Ukrainian POWs echoed throughout the park. Karina attends a pre-medical high school here. She loves synchronized swimming and doing photo shirts for Instagram with her friends. In the early morning hours of February 24th, 2022, when Karina's family first started to hear the rumble of shelling, they decided to leave Kyiv for what they thought would be the relative safety of their home in the northwestern suburb of Hostomel. She spent a harrowing first night in her basement with her cousins, aunt, and mother, explosions closing in, helicopters circling. In the morning, they realized they were in the center of the Russian advance, which first targeted Hostomel's airport. Alternating between long nights in the basement and frequent runs for supplies, Karina watched tanks roll down the neighborhood streets. Talk of escape was stifled by the revelation that Ukrainians had blown up most of the nearby bridges to slow Russia's advance. 2 years later, there are still shrapnel holes in the window of her bedroom, where she takes classes online when she doesn't commute into Kyiv. The family had eventually escaped, spending time in Poland and Slovenia, but Karina, age 16, had yearned to be home and was grateful when they returned. "Ukraine has my heart," she says. As Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine enters its fourth year, Ukrainian teens are coming of age amid the drumbeat of death and destruction, a generation forged by war. Misha and Lieb built weapons after school. Dasha teaches medical aid as a volunteer and attends funerals for soldiers and rallies for the release of POWs on weekends. Timofey dreams of being an actor. He takes theater classes in a basement and plans to leave the country before he's age 18. Other young men are intent on joining the fight. As a leadership program for youth who want to join the military when they are of age, teenage boys were packed into a gymnasium lined with mats and mirrored walls. The room felt warm and damp from body heat. Soldiers barked commands. The young men, ranging in age from age 14 to 17 and carrying rifles, dropped and jumped up and rolled on the floor until some were grunting with effort or collapsed, red-faced and gasping for breath. Their bodies were lean and muscled, grim determination in their clenched jaws. In peacetime, perhaps these boys would be star athletes or training to work in Ukraine's once burgeoning tech industry. Outside, the boys were climbing and crawling through an agility course when an air raid siren blared across the campus. Dozens of trainees dropped what they were doing and ran. They would wait in the nearest subway station until the alert was lifted. As we sat in the tunnel, I asked if they were missing out on a normal adolescence. "We are losing something," 17-year-old Igor said. Oleg, 17, finished the thought. "But we are also gaining something. Of course, if we want to have a good childhood, we can flee to Poland, but it means losing this country." Dasha spends every waking moment trying to help. "I don't have time to go to school," she told me. When we met, she was spending a Wednesday volunteering at an organization that provides training in the basics of trauma medicine to civilians. Her plans for upcoming 17th birthday was to teach a course in stopping massive bleeds and then drink kombucha with colleagues at the center. 2 days later, while photographing Dasha at the funeral of a fallen soldier, I saw a young man weaving with her camera through the packed crowd of mourners. She worked silently and confidently amid a pushy crowd of older male photographers. I wonder who this very young talent was. Later that day, at a democracy-themed high school in Kyiv's artsy Podil district, I immediately recognized her among the students. Anna, age 18, wears blue mascara and baggy jeans. She spoke perfect English. After a massive attack on Kyiv on October 10, 2022, her parents sent her to do a year of high school with family friends in suburban New York. While she found it interesting, it was excruciating for her to be away from her family where they could be in danger. She was relieved when they allowed her to come back to Kyiv to finish her senior year. In her spare time, Anna raises money for equipment for the armed forces, and she's been learning how to shoot a rifle with friends. On weekends, she helps with construction projects in the northern suburbs and works with fellow students on a community therapy garden for soldiers with PTSD. "It's important to help people clean up and rebuild," she says, "because you never know when it could be your house." In the magazine's Encore section, The Last Word, John Mulaney, an interview by Jason Newman. The beloved comedian on enjoying fame, cartoon Hollywood executives, interviewing himself, and the next iteration of his live Netflix talk show. Question by Jason Newman. What are the most important rules that you live by? Answer. Never plan more than 3 months in the future. Live by, not work by. Don't eat crackers or anything like that in bed. Even if you keep the plate right under your chin, they end up at your feet. And an easy one, but nobody knows nothing. No one's an expert. We have a complete inability to ever discuss scenarios that actually will happen, and we're all often on the wrong thread. Question by Jason Newman. Who are your heroes? Saturday Night Live music producer Hal Wilner. Hal was a total complete test. Any interest of Hal's, he researched to the nth degree. He chased down every lead in a large project of knowledge that involves ventriloquists, John Cassavetes movies and TV shows, Nelson Riddle, and Captain Beefheart albums and obscure comics. Just this Catholic knowledge of stuff that can only be described as stuff Hal was into. He likes so many things so much, and people that are really into what they do really inspire me. Question by Jason Newman. What is the best advice you've ever received? Answer. My dad told me if you're in on the phone with someone in a business conversation and you don't like what they're saying or how they're countering, just say nothing. Silence makes people crazy. They'll continue to talk. They'll probably walk back everything they said or meet you at the terms you wanted because they're so uncomfortable. Question by Jason Newman. What's the worst advice? Answer. In 2015, an extremely powerful person in Hollywood was telling me that I have to always own all my IP, which is not possible. And the guy's looking at me and goes, I know people who are famous and not rich and they're miserable. And I know people who are rich and not famous and I, John Mulaney, say, and they're happy. And he goes, no, they're miserable. And he looks at me and he goes, you need both. It was like a parody of meeting this person. I was like, is this a cutscene from The Devil's Advocate? Question by Jason Newman. You were fairly famous at this point. Answer. Not enough for this guy. Question by Jason Newman. What advice do you wish you could give your younger self? Answer. As soon as you're ready to leave Saturday Night Live, stay one more year. I wish I had. I didn't realize that when you feel burnt out is not the moment to make a decision like that. Question by Jason Newman. What do you wish someone would have told you about celebrity? Answer. I would have said to my child self, it's exactly like you picture it. And I would have said to my 20-year-old self, it's exactly like you picture it. Question by Jason Newman. Why do you say that? Answer. I hope this doesn't come out badly, but I've always been so famous in my own head that I don't think my younger self would have been fazed at all. The amount of times as a little kid I would interview myself, I was always, no matter what stage, processing the highs and lows of it. Question by Jason Newman. What are the best and worst parts of success? Answer. The best part is easy. It's what you think. The audacious headline you dreamed up in your head once it is actually written. And it just feels good. The worst part is your instincts were rewarded, but your instincts aren't always right. I guess the lesson could be, everything I think of is good. It breeds a total confusion. I don't walk away going, I'm great at doing that. I go, how did he, meaning me, 1 month in the past, nail that? And then I go, I just keep doing whatever I wanted, but that can't be it. Question by Jason Newman. You don't seem to rest on your laurels. What drives that? Answer. A bored John Mulaney is a dangerous thing. It's more the curiosity of it and the childish, but I always did that. Not always the most prudent motivation. My son says that, actually, we already did that. I thought maybe you'd want to go back. No, we already went there. Find another indoor gymnasium. Question by Jason Newman. Your son Malcolm is age 3. Has fatherhood impacted your work? Answer. I talked about him on stage, but in a limited way, I have no take on him. I'm totally absorbed. He's my guy. Question by Jason Newman. Do you get imposter syndrome? Answer. No. One of my problems is not that I don't feel really at home doing entertainment. I have other problems. Question by Jason Newman. Will the new episodes of your talk show be similar to last year's? Answer. I don't know. It was a 6-night pop-up show, and it was really fun to try. I felt like a lot of instinctual things worked out. I'm very committed to diving into irrelevance, never being relevant. This ties into a few things: recklessness, overplanning, and taking calls. A lot of stuff we did in the first six will continue. And the final question. The overriding sentiment seems to be that it was a show that shouldn't have worked but did. Answer, yeah. Except that everything that shouldn't work always does. And that's the end of the interview with John Mulaney. All by Himself, an article by Andy Green. Eric Carmen was a power pop genius behind songs like Go All the Way and All by Myself. But the musician's perfectionism, personal demons, and obsession with conspiracy theories haunted him until his still unexplained death. As soon as he answered his phone, Clayton Carmen knew he was getting bad news. It was March 2024, and by then nearly a decade had passed since he had seen his father, Eric Carmen, the power pop trailblazer and Raspberry's frontman, best remembered for the hits Go All the Way, All by Myself, and Hungry Eyes. Clayton's stepmother, Amy, was on the other end of the line. The 27-year-old hadn't seen her since his high school days, when Clayton knocked on the door of the house that Amy shared with his dad in an attempt to finally reconcile their differences. Carmen and Amy responded to the overture by closing the curtains, calling the police, and reporting a trespasser. I remember going, oh boy, if you're calling me, I can't imagine this is good, Clayton says. She told me, your dad died yesterday. Eric Carmen's brother, Fred, received a similar call from Amy. Fred hadn't communicated with his older brother since 2016, even though they were as close as siblings could be for the first 55 years of his life. Fred blames Amy for inspiring a series of lawsuits that separated Eric from his brother, his son, and 24-year-old Catherine Carmen, Eric's only other child. He has some questions. I said, was he sick? Were there issues? Fred says, she said no. We went out to dinner the night before, and Eric seemed fine. We watched TV before going to bed. The next morning, I ran some errands while he slept in like he always did. When I came home, he was gone. I'm not commenting on my husband's death, but that is not what I said to Fred Carmen, says Amy Carmen, who initially declined to be interviewed for this article, but eventually responded to a list of inquiries. In search of more details about his brother's passing, Fred says he phoned the coroner's office in Maricopa County, Carmen had lived in Paradise Valley, Arizona, to ask for a copy of the autopsy report. He was told it wasn't available, and later learned that Amy had filed a lawsuit against the police, fire department, medical examiner, and the country's public health office to prevent the autopsy report's release, even to Carmen's children. Amy says, we should get all the respect of being remembered for accomplishments during our time here, not the most personal moment in our lives, the time we leave this earth. Last September, a judge agreed with Amy, stating that the release of records relating to Carmen's death would cause Amy and the estate substantial grief and harm. On Eric Carmen's official website the day after his death, a vague announcement informed fans only that he had died in his sleep over the weekend. 11 months later, the exact cause of Carmen's death at age 74 is just one of many questions about his enigmatic life that linger. Why did the singer, fiercely private, though so public in his support of Donald Trump during his final years, posting furious MAGA missives that horrified many longtime friends and fans? Why did he almost completely abandon his musical career after scoring worldwide hits in the late 1980s? What caused him to sever ties with his only children? And how did the family schism widen to the point that Amy is now accusing Clayton and Catherine of once plotting their father's murder in one of multiple lawsuits Amy has been involved in following Eric Carmen's death? In an attempt to answer these questions, I spent the past 6 months reporting on Carmen's life through interviews with family members, his former manager, close friends, bandmates, and fellow musicians who drew a lifetime of inspiration from his work. The complex portrait that emerged varies wildly depending on who's doing the telling. His bandmate and friends, who stayed with him to the end, described Carmen as a kind and generous suburban dad, happily retired, madly in love with Amy, and shattered by the loss of his relationship with his kids. His brother, children, and ex-wife Susan, however, describe a bitter, paranoid conspiracy theorist, haunted by the past, lost in the face of shifting musical tastes, hopelessly addicted to alcohol, and manipulated by Amy to turn on his family. Amy strongly denies turning Carmen against his children and claims they wanted nothing from their father besides his money in the last decade of his life. "I loved Eric and stood by him through the tough times, unlike his brother and his children," Amy says. "Eric had every reason for wanting to be estranged from his family. But please be sure to blame the new wife." The one thing nobody disputes is that Carmen was a perfectionist and musical genius. "After he died, I saw he hadn't made music in over 25 years, says Stephen Van Zandt. "I was like, God damn. It's such a shame. Because I can tell you as a writer, performer, arranger, and producer, his records were some of the greatest ever made. They were right at the top. Right at the top." The final arc of Carmen's life began in 2014 when he came across the Facebook page of a former NBC affiliate meteorologist in Cleveland. It was Amy Murphy, who was then living in Arizona. Carmen, still in Cleveland at the time, began an online and then in-person courtship with Amy, ultimately marrying her in 2016. "I received a Facebook direct message from him," Amy said, at Carmen's memorial service last year. She said, "It simply read, 'Do you know where you were? Did you know you were my favorite weather girl when you were in Cleveland?'" Before long, the couple moved into a new house together in Cleveland. From the start, Carmen's children, Clayton and Catherine, didn't take to Amy. "The comparison I always make is to The Parent Trap. I always think of Amy as the evil stepmom slash girlfriend," Clayton says. "When my dad was around, she was very smiley, happy, and sweet. But my sister and I knew from the very beginning that she was really, really bad news. My father was just a very manipulable, paranoid, isolated person," he continues. "And suddenly someone comes into his life, and instead of his kids, who will push back on him, she's a syncopate. She'll say yes to whatever he wants. She'll agree with him on his zaniest, most deranged conspiracy theories. She was just what he wanted." Amy emphatically denies his characterization of their relationship. She says, "I never asked him for anything. Unlike the other barnacles in Eric's life, I didn't need anything." A page from Catherine Carmen's diary dated February 12, 2016, when she was 15, reveals her state of mind while living part-time with Amy and her father, Eric Carmen. "I can't stop dwelling on how much I hate him," she wrote. "Clayton and I have discussed killing Eric and driving his Jaguar to California. Our plan sounds better and better. I got so angry tonight I couldn't stop shaking. I can't be responsible for my own actions at this point." The diary entry was cited as evidence that Clayton and Catherine were planning Eric's murder in a recent legal filing by Amy's attorneys. "Amy took multiple photos of my diary to drive a wedge into the relationship with my father," Catherine writes in an email to Rolling Stone. She goes on to say, "These antics started as soon as she moved into the house. She would often comb through my brother and I's room, looking for anything that could harm a parent-child relationship. I am truly saddened that Amy would try to publicly misuse the private ramblings of a child who was experiencing so much heartbreak and pain at home. Of course, my brother and I never had any intention of causing physical threat to her father, as she's suggesting." In April 2018, Carmen and Amy left Ohio to resettle in Arizona, but withheld telling the other members of the Carmen family. They resisted any attempt by Clayton and Catherine to reconnect as well. This was Eric's choice, Amy says. Eric had no desire to reestablish contact with any of them. Eric's legal counsel and all of his close friends know that they are individually and collectively making his life a living hell. According to their close friends, Carmen was extremely happy in the final 6 years of his life and even drastically reduced his drinking, a problem with alcohol that had plagued him for much of his career. Amy was really good for him, says Raspberry's drummer John Belfonte. She was a different person than Eric, but she's smart and she really loved him. He was as happy as I'd ever seen him. Bernie Hogia, who co-wrote the 2011 biography Eric Carmen, Marathon Man, with Ken Sharp, echoes Belfonte's assessment. I've never seen him happier, he says. She really grounded him. The start of Carmen's relationship with Amy happened to coincide with the political rise of Donald Trump. Carmen became one of Trump's staunchest celebrity defenders on Twitter, especially when COVID began, which she saw as a conspiracy to undermine the then president. He wrote in a tweet, "Unemployment skyrocketed. The lockdown crashed Trump's economy. Teachers don't want schools to open. People lost businesses they worked their whole lives for. All to hurt Donald Trump. We've just collateral damage. And the real point is mandatory vaccination with an ID for all." When Joe Biden won the 2020 election, Carmen had a public meltdown on Twitter, slamming the mainstream media, stating, "It is time to turn off the MSM mass. Watch Newsmax and OANN. The entire MSM has called the election for Biden. Not surprising, since they're all part of it. Please, President Trump, do not concede." In the tense weeks that followed, Carmen started to tweet slogans associated with the fringe right QAnon movement, like, "The storm is coming," along with absurd lies about Dominion and Smartmatic voting machines rigging the election, and fevered, Alex Jones-style declarations about an impending apocalypse. "I know all about the Great Reset," he tweeted on November 17, 2020. "I'm wondering how they intend to accomplish it. I've been thinking more along the lines of taking out the power grid and the financial system in one massive cyber attack. Whatever it is, it will make COVID look like a small bump in the road." Some of his friends did their best to ignore Carmen's online outbursts. "When he went sideways politically, we just didn't discuss politics," says Stephen Van Zandt. "That's what I do with all my friends when we differ. We may differ politically, but I don't write people off that way. I'm like, hey, we see these things differently politically, and that's okay. Let's not make that part of the conversation. We've got plenty of other things to talk about." Back in Cleveland, Carmen's kids were aghast. "The most I can make sense of it is that he did struggle with depression," says his daughter Catherine. "He wasn't religious, and I think he was almost vulnerable to that sense of belonging on in life that Trump provided. Our jaws were on the ground as we saw everything unfold with his politics. The more that Trump appeared on my TV, the more I would pick up on certain little things about him that reminded him of my dad," says his son Clayton. "Just as much as you look at Trump as a textbook narcissist, my dad was a narcissist to the most textbook degree." There's no denying the musical talent of Eric Carmen. Even before he entered kindergarten, the Cleveland Institute of Music recognized something in the boy. His Aunt Muriel was then a world-renowned viola player in the Cleveland Orchestra, and it was clear that her tiny nephew, who loved to hang out in the theater whenever she rehearsed, soaking up the music like a sponge, inherited her gift. "He was playing piano before he could walk," says Fred Carmen. "I could bang my spoon on a steel bowl, and he'd go C-flat. He literally had perfect pitch. When Carmen was just 3 and a half, the Cleveland Institute of Music offered him an enrollment. To this day, by all accounts, he holds the record as the youngest student in the 104-year history of the organization. It didn't take him long to master a multitude of classical instruments, including piano and violin, but he switched to guitar as a 14-year-old after seeing the Beatles perform on the Ed Sullivan Show in 1964. "I took guitar lessons at the same time," says Fred. "It was very frustrating for me because I was going through one book every 3 months. He was going through 3 books every 3 days. He just had an incredible natural talent. His proficiency on guitar helped him stand out in the school, for he very much felt like an outsider. He had a complex about being the Jewish kid with very curly hair," says Catherine Carmen. "He saw the Beatles with their straight British cuts. He really, really wanted that hair, and I think he just became obsessed with trying to get it straight. Getting his hair just right was a lifelong quest. By the late 1980s, he toured with a large suitcase devoted solely to hairbrushes and sprays." In the late 60s, Carmen became a local teenage legend for his ability to take complex songs like "Walk Away, Renee," "Sloop John B.," and "The Kids Are All Right," and create them on stage. He played in various bands and hullabaloo clubs and bars all across Cleveland and surrounding suburbs, eventually streaming up with the cream of the local scene, drummer John Bonfante, guitarist Wally Bryson, and bassist Dave Smalley. They called themselves the Raspberries, not after the fruit, but the slang term for blowing air out of your mouth as an angry retort. "Eric knew exactly what he wanted the band to be," said Bonfante. "He wanted us to have something different and special. He was on a mission. A big part of that mission was eschewing the excesses that had crept into rock by the early 1970s. To Carmen, pop music peaked around the time of the Beach Boys' Pet Sounds and the Beatles' Revolver, and he had no interest in drum solos, 10-minute songs, or anything felt remotely like progress. I remember Eric saying, 'You won't hear any flute solos in this band,' says Bonfante. 'We wanted to be the next Beatles,' which was a pretty lofty goal. They took at least a step towards that goal in 1972 when they released their self-titled debut album on Capitol Records, the same label as the Fab Four. Carmen, Bryson, and Smalley, all still in their early 20s, each came to the sessions with songs they'd written on their own. But Carmen's songs stood out, especially "Go All the Way," inspired by the Rolling Stones' "Let's Spend the Night Together." It's a 3.5-minute blast of guitar and layered vocal harmonies with lyrics told from the perspective of a young woman urging on her boyfriend. "He heard the whole thing in his head," says Bonfante, "and relayed what he was hearing to us. Go All the Way slowly climbed the Billboard Hot 100 through the summer and fall of 1972, eventually peaking at a number 5. But Capitol Records had no idea what to do with the Raspberries. The first LP came with a sticker that smelled like a raspberry when you scratched it, and they were marketed to teens in magazines like Tiger Beat. Their first tour was sponsored by Carefree Sugarless Gum and played largely to high schools. The record label never figured us out," says Bonfante, "and our big mistake was not finding the right manager. We handled everything ourselves, and that sort of screwed us." The Raspberries' second LP, Fresh, hit just 7 months after the first LP. On the cover, they look like an early disco band in matching white suits with giant black tab collars. Once again, all the best songs were Carmen originals, notably "I Want to Be With You" and "Let's Pretend," both power pop classics that pulsate with a Brian sense of sorrow and yearning. The critics, however, were underwhelmed. After listening to them for a month, sniped Robert Christgau, the so-called dean of American rock critics, "All I remember is 3 songs. Van Zandt says the reaction was unfair. The Raspberries were like the Who meets the Beatles, the E Street Band guitarist says. And now when you look back, you realize they were inventing power pop. But by 1973, just 1 year after Go All the Way, the Raspberries were falling apart due to personality conflicts, poor management, and differing musical visions. When the dust settled, Bafante and Smalley were out, and Carmen and Bryson leapt forward with two new bandmates, bassist Scott McCarl and drummer Michael McBride, to cup the optimistically titled Starting Over LP in 1974. Even then, they weren't on the same page. "He was really into the Beach Boys," says Bryson. "I didn't see the point in that. I didn't think you could beat the Beach Boys at their own game." With his capital deal on the line, Carmen poured everything he had into a new song, Overnight Sensation. It had been two very long and frustrating years since he had a genuine hit record, and the 5.5-minute mini opera was a plea for recognition told from the perspective of an outsider, which is most decidedly how Carmen felt. At 25, he was in danger of becoming a one-hit wonder. What happened instead to the Raspberries isn't unique in rock history. Their influence wasn't recognized until long after they ceased to exist. The band went on to inspire significantly more successful groups like Cheap Trick and Kiss, and even motivate Bruce Springsteen to lean into pop when making The River in 1979. "One of my favorite records that summer was the Raspberries' greatest hit," Springsteen said in 1998. "They were great little pop records. I loved the production. And when I went into the studio, a lot of things we did were like that. 2-, 3-, 4-minute pop songs coming one right after another." Springsteen borrowed Raspberry's song titles I'm a Rocker and I Want to Be With You, both written by Carmen, and used them on new songs he cut for the River LP. "Bruce is not shy," says Steven Van Zandt. "He believed in my philosophy, which is you're only as cool as who you steal from." This concludes the reading of the Rolling Stones magazine. This is Wallace Kleindienst. This is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Then under Programming Links, left click on On Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.